Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to what will be the last official episode of Season 5 of Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast. Fear not, I will be back very soon with Season 6. But for this episode, I am joined by Dr. Claire Kambametu, who was my very first guest back in 2019. After I did my first solo episode where I shared my own anxiety story, she was the first expert who helped me to just unpack exactly what anxiety is and what's going on and just distill a lot of the overwhelming information into something really digestible. So Claire is back, and this time we are kind of going back to basics really on anxiety, because I think it's important every now and then to remind ourselves what's going on as we go off down different tangents of different kinds of anxieties and different ways of managing it. So this time we're looking at a very standard formulation exercise that would occur in a therapist's office when you're doing cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's called the 5 P's, and it's to help you better understand your anxiety. I find it incredibly helpful. It's very simple and it's a very easy approach to figuring out what's going on and why you're here before you go about making the changes or implementing certain things that will address the anxiety and help you feel better. So this is a huge, huge, huge part of the owning it process, and Claire explains it so well. So I hope you get something from this. I certainly did. It's always helpful for me to go back and revisit certain things. So do enjoy. Dr. Claire Kambametu, she's brilliant. She's a regular speaker at various events around Ireland and online. And she's also part of Georgie Crawford's The Good Glow wellness program that is available now, and her topic is all about self-worth, which we can never have too much of. So go check that out, and thank you as always for tuning in, for your reviews, and for sharing. I really appreciate it. Claire Kambametu, I'm so thrilled to have you back on Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast. You were my very first guest of this podcast back in 2019, and you set me up for what would become this series that has now, I hope, made an impact on so many different people. And I still get feedback from that first episode where you just explained it in such a digestible way. So I want to start by just thanking you for that experience many moons ago now.
I'm delighted to be back and speaking with you again. And it's funny, I actually hadn't realized at the time that I was the first podcast guest. And I remember you saying it to me, but didn't take it in. And now I'm just feeling like it's such an honor. So yeah, delighted to be back.
Just for a bit of background, can you just start by reminding us your experience, your role, and how you work with people?
Sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist, and what that means is that I work with people of all different ages when they're not feeling so great. And sometimes when they are feeling great and they want to keep that up, I firmly believe that our mental health is just as important as our physical health to take care of on a regular basis. And so we need to be looking at how things are for us and checking in with ourselves and helping ourselves to feel as good as we can do emotionally. And so that's what I try to do in my work, is to help people feel better if they're not feeling great, and help them to maintain good mental health when they are feeling good.
Absolutely. And you do it so well, and you share such incredible content, even on your Instagram, just that people can say, oh, this is something I can actually take and work with. This is actually the last episode of this season. So I wanted to, I guess, go back to basics in some ways, because we've dived into so many different topics over the course of this series. Not that it's the last episode ever, but just I felt like it was time to maybe just take a step back and recover some old ground, and maybe just remind ourselves about anxiety in its most simplest sense. And something that I was really interested that you were sharing was a framework to better understand your anxiety using the 5 P's. So I would love if we could just get stuck into that wherever you feel like it makes sense to start.
Sure. So I suppose one of the biggest questions that people ask me is, how do I know if I have anxiety? And I think for a lot of people, that's a really big question. Like, the very step in helping ourselves work on anything is identifying that we have difficulty in the first place. And so anxiety, just to define it, is really an umbrella term that covers lots of different types of problems. So there's lots of different diagnoses that somebody might receive if they go to see a mental health professional or their doctor. Things like generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, phobias of particular kinds, where somebody might be frightened, really frightened of spiders or really frightened of small spaces. But anxiety more generally is just a sensation in our bodies that results from an influx of chemicals, things like adrenaline and cortisol. And those chemicals have an impact on how we feel physically. So we might feel restless or keyed up or on edge or quite tense. We might notice changes in our sleeping, where we're sleeping a lot more, or maybe sleeping a lot less, finding it harder to go to sleep, or waking up in the middle of the night and not being able to fall back to sleep, and nothing to do with maybe small children who might prevent us from doing that. We might notice changes in our appetite, where perhaps we feel a little bit sickly and don't want to eat as much, or maybe where we're eating a lot more than we usually would. We might notice things like feeling dizzy, feeling tension in our arms and our legs and the back of our shoulders. We might notice like a kind of butterfly sensation in our tummy. And all of these things are caused by those chemicals, adrenaline and cortisol, that result from anxiety. And so I think it's just really helpful for people to know what the kind of common symptoms of anxiety might be. And I don't know if you've anything to add in to that, Caroline, about what your experience has been, how you kind of first noticed it.
I mean, well, for me, it was really very much all of the physical symptoms that were building up and up. I didn't connect the dots between, you know, what was going on physically and how I was feeling emotionally. I didn't have that awareness. I didn't have the language back in when it really was bad for me. So my body, I guess, was communicating me in all these ways. And it felt like I was about to jump out of a plane when I was just sitting on my sofa at home. You know, that feeling of just nervousness of, I felt it even tingling in the palms of my hands. My sleep fell off the face of the earth. And of course, as I know now as well, with having a baby, sleep deprivation is a whole other issue in and of itself. And when you add that onto the mix of whatever you're feeling stressed about, it can just grow arms and legs. And I think for me, like, one of the biggest learnings I've had about anxiety over this whole experience has been, you might not always be able to identify a very, you know, something to put your finger on and say, this is why I'm anxious and this is what I need to resolve. Because for me, when it was all about that job that I was in and then I left the job, I thought, well, this should solve it. So here I am now, I've left the job, I've walked away from the situation that started the stress, and I'm still feeling incredibly anxious. So I think to understand it in that way, that it's not just something you necessarily just turn off or turn on, like the chemicals, they take so much time to almost get to that point where they're so off kilter, and then time to come back to being on balance again. So yeah, there's so much in it. For me, it was so physical. I think some people who message me really seem to only experience like very worrying thoughts, where they'll just think worst case scenario, or they'll think, especially people with babies, like I get a lot of messages saying, I just can't stop thinking something really bad is going to happen to my baby. It can be very cognitive. And then for some people, it's very physical, and not, they don't necessarily know what they're worrying about. They're just feeling uneasy. And sometimes that's really unnerving, because you're you're looking for something to make sense of it and you can't.
That's so important, isn't it, to note that some people do have very specific triggers or maybe things in their lives that are going on that they know they feel anxious about. But for a lot of us, what we know now is that we can start sometimes worrying about the worry. And that's a lot harder to even put our fingers on and to realize what we're kind of worrying about. And so, yeah, sometimes there isn't a very clear trigger. It's just a feeling that kind of, and a horrible feeling that sits in our bodies and stays there for such a long time. I think that's a really helpful distinction, actually.
For me, it's always been really helpful. I don't know if you agree, but it's always been helpful for me to try and find the source of it or try and make sense of it. But for some people, I think in neuroscience, anyway, from different experts I've talked to, there's less of an emphasis on going back and finding out why and just dealing with the here and now and how to, I guess, calm the anxiety. So what would your take be? And then let's go with the first P of the five Ps.
I think there's value in both things, in my experience. I think for somebody who has a lot of quite intense symptoms of anxiety, the biggest focus for me in working with somebody would be on helping to relieve that so that on a day-to-day basis, they start to feel better. It might not be about, you know, it mightn't get rid of the anxiety in the long term, but actually just to help somebody be able to sleep a little bit better or to just feel a little bit less panicked by helping them to manage their symptoms. So looking at kind of the triggers, if there is one, but then also kind of validating their anxiety and their experience if there isn't a clear trigger, and helping them to do the things that can just reduce the symptoms of anxiety in the body. Things like deep breathing, meditation, challenging the thoughts when it's possible to do that, or just sitting with the thoughts and allowing the anxiety to be there if it's not possible to challenge them, kind of making friends with it. I think that's really helpful when somebody is in those really chronic, intense stages of anxiety. And then for somebody who maybe has managed their symptoms a little bit better, but is wondering why it's still persisting, or maybe is finding that it's not enough, I would be looking at doing that kind of longer term therapeutic work around the reasons why they might have developed anxiety in the first place. And for some people that is helpful, for other people it's not. It's not, you know, a helpful thing. And so I'm always guided by what the person in front of me actually wants to do, because I think we all know ourselves, even if we feel like we don't, we know ourselves better than anybody else. And we can kind of intuitively know or tap into what we need and what is helpful in our own journey sometimes.
For me, it's just validating whether it's something that is happening right now or something from the past. If I can say, this makes sense, then it takes a little bit of the pressure off me for being hard on myself or feeling anxious in the first place. And that already reduces the anxiety even just a little bit. I think sometimes understanding where it's coming from can make you find it a little bit easier to bring some self-compassion on the scene. So I would be an advocate to know what's going on. But I guess, like you say, each to their own, whatever people find helpful.
I think that's a really helpful point about self-compassion as well, like, because one of the things that anxiety, I notice, really brings up in myself and in everybody else I know who experiences it, which is, by the way, everybody, because all of us go through times when we're more anxious or we're less anxious. And so self-compassion, like, we can really judge ourselves so harshly for feeling anxious when we don't judge ourselves for, like, having tripped and broken our leg, or, you know, hurting our back, or doing something physical to our bodies. We never, you know, judge ourselves really harshly for that stuff. It's just something that we take for granted. We'll get injured. Don't bring the same kind of compassion or understanding or allowance to our minds to kind of go, well, you know, life is hard and sometimes it sucks. And sometimes during my life, my mind is going to be injured, and that's okay. So I think that's so important, what you've said there about bringing that self-compassion when we can. And yes, sometimes understanding it allows us to bring that in a little bit more easily. I know that's my experience too, Caroline. But yes, going to the first P. So if somebody goes to see a psychologist, they will do something called formulation with their client. And that is where you develop a kind of big picture of what has happened for the person, what has resulted in them developing a particular issue, what has maybe been the trigger, if it's possible to identify, to the issue in the more immediate sense, and then what is kind of maintaining the problem, what is it keeping it going and feeding it, and then also what is helpful for the person in their life, like what are the protective things that they're doing, what are the support systems they have in place. So the very first P of that model, which is called the 5 P's model, is something called predisposing factors. And that is things that have happened in our early life or in our history growing up as an adolescent, maybe into early adulthood, things that have happened that mean it's more likely that we will develop anxiety in this case. And so some of those things, in case people are wondering, like, well, what, you know, what are predisposing factors? Like, what does make me more vulnerable to that? These are things like genetic inheritance in the early stages of life. If we have a parent who is more anxious in their own temperament, we are more likely to inherit an anxious temperament. And then not that we will definitely go on to develop anxiety, because there are lots of things that can be done to help a child grow up so that they don't develop it. But we are more vulnerable to developing it if we don't get those things, or if other things maybe happen to us. And then we have our very early childhood experiences. So the relationship that we have with our caregivers in the first couple of years of life has been shown to have a massive impact on how our mind develops and how our body actually develops. So in those early relationships, if there is difficulties and what are called adverse childhood experiences, somebody is more likely to grow up to develop anxiety and also other mental health problems. So it's worth people having a kind of look at adverse childhood experiences, which is shortened in a lot of research and a lot of books, etc., to ACEs, A-C-E-S, to understand kind of more of what they are. But there's 10 ACEs that have been identified as being really problematic for children. These are things like physical, sexual or emotional abuse, neglect, parental separation, parental alcohol or substance misuse, witnessing domestic violence, those kind of big T traumas, if you like, that some people experience when they're growing up. But there may be other what are called little T traumas. So those things that don't seem really dramatic, but also have an impact on how we might develop anxiety that can happen first. So little T traumas are things like maybe our parent wasn't available to help us manage our anxiety. Like kids, by our very nature as children, I mean, we all get a little bit anxious, especially for children who are around the 7-8 years of age mark, because we develop this thing very normally called magical thinking, where we imagine all sorts of scenarios. So that might be where a kid gets a really intense fear of there being a monster under the bed. Or for me, I know when I was that age, I used to have these magical thoughts about disappearing. I used to feel this real sense of anxiety that I might just vanish because I'd seen this TV program with my dad one day, and it really stuck in my mind. And so as kids, we're really vulnerable to developing anxiety, and developing it as a problem at a later point is kind of dependent on how our parents help us to manage it in the early years.
That's so interesting, because I always go back to childhood experiences and I feel guilty because I'm like, I had a great upbringing. There was none of those big T traumas, but there was probably lots of the little T ones. And I just remember feeling this intense neediness for my mom, and like they worked a lot. They both worked very hard. They had to, and they did that to provide for us. But I always had this sort of feeling of longing for more time with my mom. And around the 7-8 year old mark is when my three living grandparents died, all in a very short space of time together. And parents would say things like, oh, you know, that your granny's gone to heaven, your nana's, you know, it's okay, she's still with you. And all those things, I remember feeling so viscerally frightened about the fact that people I knew were dead. Just the idea of a dead body and that kind of thing. And I remember going in to see my grand, I've said this before on the podcast, going in to see my granddad in the morgue. Like, I probably shouldn't have, with my imagination as fertile as it was, probably would have been better off not seeing that. And I just remember going to bed each night with such consuming fear that people died, that I could die, but also people would say things like, oh, but your grandparents, they're with you, they're looking down on you. And this fucking terrified me. Like, I didn't want to be visited by any ghosts. Thank you very much. So I just have such vivid memories around that time when, I guess, another thing, you can tell me if I'm right here, but while we start to develop the ability to like have those fear responses, we haven't yet developed the ability to like rationalize and be logical. Is that right?
That is totally true, yeah.
So your parents are telling you like, don't be silly, don't be worried, and you don't have that mechanism yet. So it does feel real to you and it's valid. And I think that's where a lot of people get set up for a bit of anxiety later on in life, because our parents' generation maybe wouldn't have had the awareness, it wouldn't have had the education or the know-how to sort of not diminish a child's worry. Because of course you want them not to worry, so you tell them not to worry, but they are worrying.
Yeah, yeah. And for any adult worriers out there, I mean, you'll know this as well. I feel this. If you're worried about something and somebody comes along and says, oh, don't worry about it, or it'll all be grand, either dismissing it or reassuring us, it doesn't work. And it's the same for when we're small kids. We don't, as you've just said, we don't have the ability to rationalize, to think through something until we're a little bit older, maybe 12 or 13. And sure enough, in the short term, our parents might have tried to reassure us, but that only works for a very small amount of time. And then the worry creeps back in. And so the key is really helping children to understand that worry is normal, that worry happens for everybody, and what to do in their own minds when they're starting to feel worried. You know, the experience you've described, I think, are really about wanting to have more time with your mom, while also understanding that your parents were working really hard to create the life that they wanted for you. I think a lot of people, when it comes to looking back at those little t traumas, find it very hard to acknowledge those out of a kind of sense of loyalty, maybe to their family, and a sense of gratitude for the fact that those big t traumas didn't happen for them. But I think it's really important for everybody to acknowledge that. Well, my belief is that we don't get to adulthood without some sort of wound. We don't get to become adults without some sort of kid part of us that has been a little bit hurt or a little bit disowned or a little bit small t traumatized, because our parents are humans and they may be doing the very best job that they are able to and know how to do. But just by virtue of being humans, we all make mistakes. And so it's very normal for people to have had those experiences. And it's not helpful to kind of blame parents for it or to...
Sorry, mommy.
Yeah, that's just something. And I don't think you do that. It didn't sound like you were doing that at all. But I think it's helpful for people to know that it's okay, actually, to look back on those experiences and go, this happened to me. I do remember that. I do remember kind of feeling a little bit alone or feeling a bit worried about dead people coming to visit me at nighttime because of what my parents or family had said, meaning the best that they meant.
And it might especially seem innocuous now as an adult to be like, well, you're hardly traumatized. But as a child, you're dealing with a different brain, different stage of development. So it was a big deal. Anything that happens to you in that age that makes you a little bit frightened, it's a big deal when you are that age.
Absolutely. It is a big deal. And they're often the things that that set us up to develop anxiety at a later point. But we dismiss them because, like you've said, you know, we get to 12, 13 and we're able to rationalize. And so we start to rationalize that piece and go, oh, well, you know, that didn't matter. And of course, you know, ghosts won't come and visit me in the nighttime, or there's no monster under my bed. But we didn't know that when we were small. So it's really important that people allow themselves to just look back at those experiences they've had and how they might have felt, or the things they might have been scared of, and to look at maybe how they were taught to deal with or not to deal with worry, to maybe suppress it, and to just notice that as maybe a predisposing factor in the development of their anxiety.
So that's number one, predisposing factors.
Sorry, I should say number one is actually identifying the problem. So okay. In this case, we're talking about anxiety. So that's number one. Number two then is predisposing factors. Number three is precipitating factors. So really what that means is the kind of events in the previous maybe few months or few weeks before somebody has developed a problem. So if I'm sitting with somebody in a therapy session and it's the first time that I've met them, I'm thinking about, okay, well, what has brought this person to this point where maybe their anxiety is so intense, their problem is so big for them now that they're sitting here. And so that could be anything. It might be a relationship breakup, the death of somebody that they love. It might be losing a job. It could be any sort of change, or it may be nothing. you know, there may be no clear trigger other than their anxiety continuing to grow and the person becoming more and more worried about the anxiety and kind of feeding it in that way. So it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So precipitating factors is all about what has happened just kind of before this problem has become this.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Big.
So for me then, if we use me as an example, it would have been a significant change that I went through just around the time that I started to feel bad. So I moved out of my house, I changed jobs, I didn't like the job I changed into. So my life changed, you know, it didn't seem like a big deal to most people, but there was a lot of change in a very quick period of time, and it wasn't change that I really enjoyed.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So that's a really good description. And for everybody, it will be different. And also, even for the same person, they might have different episodes of high anxiety, and there might be different precipitating factors to each of those. So the things that have happened to them in their life history are going to stay the same, because, of course, they've already happened. But I know for me, at times when I felt more anxious, there's been maybe different precipitating factors in the run-up to that. So that's important to note as well.
Oh yeah, so that's changing all the time, because, you know, your anxiety could be rising and falling. And like, I always refer to my big anxiety experience, but my precipitating factors change all the time, such as I just had a baby. So this is why I'm feeling incredibly anxious. You know, this is what's led up to this right now.
Yes, exactly. And the reason why it's helpful to figure those out, if we can, is we can then figure out if they're kind of maintaining the problem, which I'll talk about in a minute. But we can also figure out if there's things that we need to just acknowledge or validate, like in the situation you've described where you've just had a baby, you know, validating the difficulty, the challenge, the hardship in that, as well as the joy that it can bring, is really important. Because if we don't validate that experience, if we don't acknowledge maybe what's just happened in our lives, we can't really move on, or we can't fully understand what it is that's going on for us. It does bring that extra layer of understanding. And then, yes, yeah, sometimes the precipitating factors, so the things that have just happened in the run-up to this time, may also be what are called perpetuating. So the fourth P, they may also be perpetuating factors. And perpetuating factors are things that keep the problem going. So if we're in an intensely stressful situation, I know for me previously, it's been one of the things that's triggered, have been a precipitating factor, has been grief. And so that grief is something then that's going to keep the problem going, because just because I've realized that it's been a trigger for anxiety, it doesn't disappear. You know, having a baby, the baby doesn't disappear. It's still going. It's still ongoing. And so perpetuating factors are, yes, those things that are in our lives that keep the anxiety going. So perhaps a stressful event, but they're also the things that we do in our minds that keep the problem going.
So thought patterns or anxiety mind traps that we fall into where it becomes a habit.
Yes, exactly. And are often the bigger ones and the things that are more important to get a handle on, because we can't control those external events. You know, we can't undo something that has or hasn't happened for us. We can't control what's happening in the world. But what we can learn to start bringing awareness to and to start trying to control a little bit more is those habits, those thinking patterns that you've mentioned. I don't know if you've noticed in your experience if there's other perpetuating factors, other things that have kept your anxiety going.
I think there's definitely things that people take for granted, such as, you know, if you keep fueling yourself with caffeine when you're in an anxious phase, that could maybe add to it and keep it going. Or, you know, just diet in general, like if lots of stimulants when you're already quite stimulated. It's something that I would be mindful of. If I go into an anxious period, it'll be kind of the low hanging fruit that I will look at first is, okay, well, I'm going to step away from this, I'm going to step away from that, because that will just keep me on that treadmill of anxiety. And also just another perpetuating factor for me, I don't know if this would qualify as one in your book, but just the very act of resisting it and creating more tension by being hard on myself and by just trying so hard not to feel that way and just talking yourself down for the fact that, oh, here I am again, feeling anxious again. It's just keeping you on that feedback loop of anxiety. So for me, it's sometimes stopping and saying, okay, here I am now, and be in it and sit with the discomfort of it for a little while.
Mm-hmm. They are such important points. The first thing that you said about the low-hanging fruit, the things that we're actually putting into our bodies, or maybe not prioritizing trying to get more sleep, which I do believe is a superpower. And another thing I actually see quite a lot of people experiencing is just an increase in alcohol. And God knows I love a glass of wine as much as the next person, and sometimes more. But alcohol can make our anxiety an awful lot worse. It does have an impact on our neural biological system, and that's an important point for anybody just to consider without seeming too pious or preachy about it.
Could another one maybe be like if you are the type of person that's always saying yes to people or a people pleaser, like would that be a precipitating factor that just keeps feeding it in maybe a different kind of anxiety where you're anxious about what people think of you?
Yes, exactly. Because sometimes what we do with our thoughts is we kind of succumb to them rather than challenging them and going, OK, it doesn't matter what this person thinks of me. I need to say no for my own mental health because I actually can't afford to take on anymore. We go with this kind of idea or this thought or belief that we have to keep other people happy. And in doing so, we reinforce this idea that I have to keep other people happy because we never challenge our experience. We never challenge that thought enough to learn, well, what happens actually when I don't keep other people happy? What happens if other people don't like me as much because I say no to them? So we kind of don't give ourselves the chance to rehabilitate properly. We don't give ourselves the chance to learn from new experiences that actually somebody cannot like us and our world doesn't fall apart. We don't crumble. We don't become a terrible person. And I just want to go back to what you were saying there as well about self-compassion and how sometimes that trap of judging ourselves really harshly and then that making the problem worse is another perpetuating factor. I thought that was really important too.
Yeah, I think that's a big one that we tend to overlook probably. It seems like of all of the P's so far, perhaps identifying the perpetuating factors might not be so easy because we might be blind to the things that we're doing that are keeping us going. So what kind of questions can someone ask themselves to help identify those factors?
That's a really good question. I think the first thing is to look at the low-hanging fruit, as you were saying, the kind of things that we are doing. It's easier to spot our behaviours and it's easier for other people to spot our behaviours than it is sometimes to tune into our thoughts. So the first thing is kind of going, what am I doing? Am I doing something on a daily basis, whether it's avoiding situations that make me anxious because that feeds the problem, that keeps it going? Am I using alcohol or drugs or maybe other things to manage my anxiety like caffeine or nicotine or anything else? You know, is there something that I'm doing? Am I creating situations whereby my anxiety gets worse? Maybe I'm putting myself in situations without actually resourcing myself, giving myself kind of coping mechanisms to manage the anxiety. And then I escape those situations because I can't handle the level of anxiety and just feel worse about myself. I think a really helpful thing, if there's a trusted other person in somebody's life, is to actually ask them to sit down and have a conversation about anxiety with that other person, because the people we're closest to are often less blinkered than we are about the things we're doing. And it might be hard to hear. I think it can be hard to hear from a partner or from a friend or somebody that we love that, you know, they can see we're kind of contributing to our problem, but it can also help us if we're open to it to look at things a little bit more honestly. And so spotting those behaviours that are keeping it going, using ourselves and other people in our lives, is really good.
And what about the journaling side of things?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. I think that's just, journaling for me is probably one of the biggest resources I have in my life, whether it's about trying to tune into what's really going on in my head, or just release some of that kind of pent up emotion and energy if I don't have another way of doing that. I find it really powerful in both aspects. And I think sometimes it's so messy what happens in my mind and for other people too. It's very difficult to like disentangle our thoughts. And by writing them down, by actually bringing them into conscious awareness and writing them down, we can just gain a bit more clarity and maybe see how negative our thinking has become, or maybe how we are worrying about an awful lot more than we used to. And I think journaling as well, if somebody is struggling to know where to start, or maybe feeling like, oh, well, I don't want to write down my innermost thoughts into something, just start by creating an appointment with yourself on a weekly basis, you know, on a Monday or a daily basis if it helps you, but definitely weekly, and going, right, on Mondays at 7 o'clock, I'm going to give myself 10 minutes to just set aside and check in with myself and just note, have I been more anxious or more stressed or more overwhelmed this week? Has my mental health changed from how it was last week? Am I suffering more? Am I suffering less? Without doing anything with this information, just noting how you're actually doing is a really helpful start to the process of journaling, because we have so many thousands and thousands of thoughts a day. And for somebody like you, Caroline, I think you're so aware of what you're thinking, having done kind of so much work around your own anxiety. But for lots of people, when they're just learning about anxiety, as I think you were saying earlier, was your experience at the start, you know, we don't know what's going on in our heads. It can be just really hard to even write it out. So yeah, I think that's a helpful start.
I actually have in my journal, Own It, the anxiety journal, I thought it was a lot of pressure on people to track their thoughts every day, because sometimes you just want a bit of escapism. You don't want to be in the depths of your thoughts every day. But once a week, you're invited to look back at the week that's been and look ahead to the week that's coming and look at your thoughts and feelings and behaviors and what, how each one influenced the other in a very non-judgmental, gentle way. You know, it's just once a week if you want to do it, to just see how things are shaping up for you over a period of time. And like you say, it's just noting it. You don't have to do anything with it. Maybe you could say, I noticed that I tend to have quite anxious thoughts around this particular time of month. Maybe it's to do with your period, because I did an episode on that just recently. Or maybe it's to do with a particular deadline in work, or maybe it's when I see a particular person in my family. And just to get that observation piece done, I think journaling is really helpful for, and it kind of helps me in another way, because even just by writing something down, and it's just for yourself, I mean, it can be in your bedside locker, no one ever has to see it. You put yourself in the driving seat of your anxiety and you're already doing something to address it. And even that alone as an exercise makes me feel like I'm taking ownership. And then that already helps me to feel less like I'm just swirling around in an anxious wave.
Yeah, there's a form of therapy called self-compassion therapy or self-compassion theory, which I know you've spoken a bit about. And the first step to being more self-compassionate with ourselves is actually just taking a moment to acknowledge what is happening for us and kind of validate our own experience. Just going, I am anxious. I am suffering. This is hard. Just by doing that actually has a biological impact that reduces stress. And so, yeah, it's on a biological level really helpful, and definitely on a psychological.
That's been a complete game changer for me. And that was probably the last piece of the puzzle for me to be able to get myself back to feeling well whenever anxiety does rise up, is that compassion piece and to understand. I've talked about it so many times at this stage, but to understand it's not just a nice idea, but like you say, the biological impact that it has on your body cannot be argued with. Therefore, there's no reason not to do it or to give it a try. So we're at the final P then.
Mm-hmm. The final P, one of my favorite, it's probably my favorite P because it's protective. So this is the good stuff that we have in our lives that helps us to overcome difficulties. That means that maybe the extent of our difficulties will be smaller. And so this is the stuff that even if somebody has all of the different adverse childhood experiences that we spoke about earlier in the predisposing factors bit, they can still have lots of protective factors that actually mean that their experience with anxiety might be easier to overcome. So protective factors are things like good, warm, trusting relationships, hobbies and interests, maybe the fact that we do regular exercise or that we are in a particular socioeconomic bubble or that we live in a particular area, that we spend time outdoors. Those things in our lives that actually help us, that we, you know, maybe having good coping skills because we were an anxious kid and we had to get some help with that. So we already have a few skills built up, a willingness to change and to be open to learning about ourselves and how we can overcome anxiety. So all of those things are a protective factor.
So this is kind of what you know that helps you.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose for me, I think of it like, what's my survival guide? What do I know that will help me in the moment as opposed to what will help me long term? And I think people often tend to jump to things like what society tells us is protective or is helpful, like with the wellness industry, you know, it's yoga at 5 a.m. and it's getting up early and chanting and it's all this stuff that's very Instagram wellness. And for me, I felt that this just gave more pressure. I mean, if it works for you, great, but it's such an individual experience. You have to tap into whatever it is that you know brings you right back down to zero for you in the moment. So like asking yourself, what can I do for myself right now that will make me feel even a little bit better? And quite honestly, a lot of the time for me, it's putting on some cozy clothes, cup of tea, maybe decaf if I'm feeling anxious, some nice comforting warming food, and putting on the biggest load of shite on TV. And yeah. It's just like being able to put your brain on hibernate mode. And even though it seems trashy or not very productive, if you're giving your body that chance to just calm right down and you're not feeling those anxious thoughts, if it's taking you out of those anxious thoughts, it can only be a good thing. So for me, like my protective factors are my comforts, my comfort zone, going for a nice walk, having a great chat with someone. Just also then something practical would be looking at my diary, obviously outside of pandemic times, and thinking, have I got too much on here? Do I want to pare something back so that I can have a night in? And also coming out of the pandemic, something I've said as well is I think there's probably a lot of anxiety around being out and about and doing all these things just because we can. And staying in has been a sentencing up until now. But when we come out of this and restrictions ease, it goes back to being a choice, but it's still a very valid choice. And it's still very much a part of me being well. And I need early nights. I'm a sleepy person. So for me, like just coming up to bed with a book and I always used to feel guilty about it, like, oh, I should be doing something else with my evening. I just love being in bed. It just makes me feel, and I'm in it right now recording with you, it's just my safe haven. So your protective factors, as long as they're safe and legal and you know, not harmful, they don't have to be the prescriptive protective factors that we hear so much about.
I love what you have just said. I absolutely love it, because I think that pressure that we put on ourselves to be so productive, I mean, I don't even know where it's come from. If we rewind to our kind of cave woman and man style living of a few thousand years ago, we didn't obviously have all of these pressures to be as productive and to show other people how productive we were being. All we needed to do was actually really take care of our bodies. And that involved eating and resting. And resting is just so undervalued. And it is, you know, one of the biggest things that we can do for our mental and our physical health. And I'm not a medical doctor, but I know that with sleep, there's research to show that the absence of sleep has an impact on every physical and mental health difficulty known to humankind. And so if somebody is struggling with anxiety, often what they need to do is less rather than more, and to really give themselves permission to do as you've just described, to rest and to allow their body to rest and to heal and to be still and to be calm, as opposed to feeling like they have to do more and more and more in order to be well. So I just love what you've said there.
It's so important. And I think we're hearing more and more these days about how rest is actually still a productive thing to do. And we just find it so hard to do without the guilt. Like, what's the point? There's no point in taking rest if you're going to bring guilt up to the bed with you. You have to put that to one side. Just knowing that it's actually, even though you're lying still or you're chilling out or you're watching Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, your body is actually hard at work relaxing. So it's still doing something. I'm so bad for it myself. Like, as much as I say I love doing that, I came up to bed a while ago and I was lying down. I was like, I'm just gonna have, because it was the middle of the day, And I felt kind of guilty because I'm a mom and I should be just doing things and cooking things and, you know, any spare minute I got, because he was asleep. And I was like, I'm going to just take a moment. And I was lying down and I was like, Caroline, you're sitting here doing your pelvic floor exercises, lying down the bed. Like, can you not just not try and do something productive for 1 minute? So we need to be able to just be. Sometimes that's hard to do because, you know, as anxious people, you don't really want to just be with your thoughts. So a little bit of escapism for me is brilliant. There's a time and a place for sitting with your feelings, and there's a time and a place for, do you know what, I'm going to distract myself now. You need to have those moments as well. You know, you don't want to live completely in distraction mode, but you don't want to live completely in like deep self-analysis mode either.
No, neither is helpful, neither extreme. And actually, one of the questions that a lot of people ask when we're going through, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, where we're looking at changing our thoughts and challenging our thoughts, is, do I have to do this all of the time? Like, how do I know when I need to challenge a thought? And how do I know when it's okay to just leave it and just allow it to be there and maybe get busy doing something else? And the answer is really inside all of us, to just challenge it if you can. And if you can't, that's okay. Just sit with that and do what makes you feel good. You know, you don't have to be constantly arguing with your mind. Try it. If it doesn't work, then acceptance and doing something else that helps you is the way forward. And that'll be different for everybody.
Yeah. And to go back to the journaling, it doesn't have to be something you're doing 24/7 thinking X, you know, you're not on double time in your mind. You can just say, oh, these thoughts are coming and going. They're not super pleasant, but I'm going to sit down later on in the day and I'm going to have my 10 minutes of thinking, like, where have I been at this week? And that can be as much as you want to do. And the rest of the time you can just be allowing yourself to feel however you're feeling and guiding yourself towards things that, those more protective things that help fill your tank back up. So is this all part of, would this be within the cognitive behavioral therapy umbrella?
Yes. So that 5-piece formulation is one of the most popular, I suppose, and most well used cognitive behavioral therapy formulation. So for every different type of therapy that's used, so an example of another therapy might be psychodynamic or psychoanalytic psychotherapy, maybe acceptance and commitment therapy, self-compassion. Each type of therapy has a slightly different formulation. So this is the one that most of the psychologists I know, and including myself, would use really all the time. And then I might develop another formulation depending on if I'm going to use a different form of therapy with somebody, if they agree to it and want to do that.
But it's something that someone can do themselves as well.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's something that I think is really helpful, and just, it's like a framework, like a hanger for our understanding of how we've come to a certain point.
And then when you've gotten a clear picture of your 5 P's, if we liken it to, I suppose, the way I approached my book, Owning It, I had like the assess and the address technique. And so the assess was understanding what's going on, where it's come from, what is anxiety, why are you in this particular position? And then the address was, okay, I understand that now. So what am I going to do about it? So perhaps the 5 P's are similar to figuring out why you're here. And then once you've done that, then you can look at whether it's making lifestyle changes or adjustments, whether it's if you feel the need to go back and talk through and unpack some childhood experiences or traumatic events, or whether it's look from where you are now and go forward. The world of opportunity of things that you can do to help, it's overwhelmingly big as well. But I think the 5 P's, or the figuring out why you're here, is the most crucial work. And I believe you can't just slap a yoga class onto the end of an incredibly anxious, overwrought day and week and expect it to make a blind bit of difference if you don't understand or address what's going on in the first place. So for me, this is half the anxiety dealt with if you can get this far.
Definitely. Just bringing that little bit of understanding. And I think when we don't have that understanding around why something's going on, it can make our anxiety more of a challenge. Like that idea of just going to a yoga class and everything being better can often mean that somebody ends up feeling more anxious because it hasn't worked and they've hung all their hopes on going to yoga and that being the thing that solves their problem. Like for some people, maybe doing yoga morning, noon and night is the thing that helps them. But I think hanging our expectations on any one thing that kind of the wellness industry is telling us that we should hang it on isn't a helpful thing and can actually just make us feel worse when that doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. And like if it's an issue at work, for example, if it's someone with a very challenging boss and they're logging off every evening upset, there's only so many protective factors that you can layer on there without actually looking at the root and seeing, is this something you can actually change, because it's still going to be there. So I often find that for some of those very tangible anxieties, you really have to look at how you can change those things. And if you can't, then how can you protect yourself or change yourself, your own reaction within that situation? It's a huge topic, but I really think it's a wonderful place to start with the five P's, and also something that is worth doing with someone like such as yourself. So if someone wanted to explore this with a therapist, would they seek out a clinical psychologist who specializes in CBT and say, look, I want to do this? Or would it be something that happens just the minute you walk in the door of a therapy office?
I suppose people practice in different ways. It's something that I would be working through with somebody in the first maybe two or three sessions that we meet. It's hard sometimes to get all of the five P's out and clear within just one appointment. So I think it's helpful to find a good psychologist or therapist to work with. And then to talk to them about it in the first session, to say that it'd be good to get a better understanding of their formulation, because people share it in different ways as well. I suppose I would share it quite clearly with people that I work with now, whereas some other people might have it and might be thinking about it and being aware of it in their own minds, but maybe mightn't share that so frequently with clients. So it's something you can always talk to and ask your therapist or psychologist about. And as I said, it would differ for different forms of therapy. So if you're going to see maybe a psychologist who practices psychodynamic therapy, their formulation might look a little bit different to this. But like with any form of therapy, you know, the most important aspect we know is the quality of the relationship between the person and the therapist. And so all of this stuff is up for discussion and for talking about.
Okay, wonderful. Dr. Claire Kambametu, I can't thank you enough. It's been really wonderful for me to revisit this formulation, even for myself, just to kind of go back and remember the framework within which we're operating. And it just makes things a little bit more manageable and things make more sense. And I think it's always helpful to revisit the basics and just remind ourselves how anxiety works, what we're dealing with, how normal it is, how easy it can rise up for people, and that there is tools and techniques and there is ways out of it as well. So thank you so much for your incredible expertise and just the way that you distill the information in such a digestible way. It's really powerful.
Oh, well, thank you. And yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure and brings me in touch, I suppose, with my own anxiety as well, and just how big a problem it is for us all at the moment in society. And I hope that whoever's out there and is maybe suffering a little bit can take something from this that's helpful. So yeah, delighted to have been talking to you, Caroline.
Oh, thank you so much.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The easiest way to access Owning It Real Time is to head to the link in the episode description or episode details, whatever you call them, show notes. You will find the link
in there at the top. You can sign up right away for Owning It Real Time and access the full library of 10 situation-specific audio guides that will help you own your anxiety even more than you've ever done before.